Choke points.
Let's go.
Archaeology edition.
Let's go.
This is usually Felix Bonnell territory.
Let's go.
But it turns out that Washington's Department of Transportation has to do a little bit of, what should we call it, historical digging.
Yes.
Before it can go ahead with the construction project.
Yeah, pretty much. They have to make sure they know
what. You can't just go in with the dozer and start.
No, you know how they always tell us to go 811 before you dig?
Yes, right.
To look for any, like, power lines?
Right.
They have to do that on a giant scale to make sure, not for power lines, but for, you know, ancient settlements, you know, any historical artifacts, things like that. So the state actually has what they call a cultural resource specialist in every region. They're tasked with researching sites of potential projects, looking for settlements, historically important information. It's part of the environmental review that the state does on every project.
The same thing where we're looking at effects to fish and air quality, we're also looking to make sure we're not going to hit archaeological sites, damage historic buildings, making sure we're protecting the heritage of the people of Washington.
Cassie Menettis is the specialist for the Northwest region, which runs along either side of I-5 from Pierce County up to the Canadian border. It's her job to research these projects, talk to former residents when she can, go to the historical record, and make a plan should the project hit something important.
We're looking to see where people used to live, whether that's Native American tribes or whether that's historic settlers. We're looking to see if you've got building foundations, proximity to water. You know, if you're in a place that looks like it's nice to live today, people probably lived there in the past, and there's a chance you're going to hit something.
The state thought it might hit historic Seattle settlements when working on the Alaskan Way Viaduct replacement and tunnel project, considering that most of that area was originally a tide flat that was built up over time. Minetta says they found one just west of Pioneer Square.
We found the remnants of that neighborhood, which had been built up on piers and wharves, and then they came through eventually and filled in. And we found, you know, a lot of the pilings and the decking from those piers and wharves.
They found plates, dishes, cups, glassware, animal bones, and all sorts of other items discarded from life on the Seattle waterfront from around 1890 to 1905.
Had some really interesting opportunities to be able to see how very, very early Seattle developed. See how we were filling in the tide flats that are now Soto, you know, being able to kind of get a glimpse into the lives of these people that aren't well documented.
Now, Minetta's specialty is animal bones. And she says when she started picking up the bones that they found there, she could tell a lot about the workers and their lives by what they found.
You can tell someone's eating a T-bone versus a ribeye versus just a chuck. Something like that. So that's kind of interesting information because it can tell you things about the socioeconomic status of the people who are eating that material.
So the cheaper the cut of meat, you figure the socioeconomic, you know what I mean? And they have a nicer cut a little couple blocks away. That kind of tells you the striation of the economics there along the waterfront. So she got super excited about that when I got, you know, when I was looking at handling 100-year-old goat bones that they found. I asked Felix yesterday, and I don't believe it was a culturally significant goat, probably just a meal. So that's kind of, you know, kind of the stuff that they get into. They also found the remains of a retaining wall from the original Harrison Street regrade while working near the tunnel's north portal. They thought that it had been long gone and taken out when, you know, through all the work and the regrade in there, but it wasn't. So they, you know, cleared it out, took pictures of it before they removed it as part of the project. And to remind you just why this work is so important, you really only have to go back about 15 years. The state had to abandon a huge project in Port Angeles and eat $87 million when a major 2,700-year-old native settlement of the Klallam tribe was discovered. The state didn't think it would find anything. They did a little environmental review. They did a little research there. They didn't think they'd find anything. They found a nearly intact native village, hundreds of sets of human remains, complete buildings. So that whole project had to be scrapped. So the bottom line is you never know until you dig. And this is a very important job that I didn't realize had permanent staff positions with the Department of Transportation.
Hmm. So the plates and the other stuff they found at the Seattle waterfront, that was just tossed there?
Yeah, because back then there wasn't a garbage service on the tidal flats. So,
that's
yeah, they just kind of toss things into the pit. They can tell also the socioeconomic by, you know, what kind of pottery it was. Was it China? Yeah. Was it porcelain?
I was thinking that they should impose a retroactive fine.
If you're a descendant of the folks who live there at what is now west of Pioneer Square.
Cleaning up your stuff.
Yeah. So, yeah, it's pretty interesting. And then, you know, some of the more important things they found, I think, have made their way to Mohai. The Burke. And then some of the other things, there are pictures up at mynorthwest.com of some of the pottery they found and some of the things. They gave me a box of things I could grab them and hold them. There was something from, like, the Bayview Soda Company that looked, just like an old, our version of a Coke bottle, broken, happened a really intricate etched glass bottle. It was kind of neat. So, yeah, it was fun. It was great, and Cassie seems to really enjoy, which, I mean, it's kind of not exactly Dr. Jones, but it's fun, and I like this kind of stuff. So,
and that's time for the Daily Dose of Kindness.
Why, yes, it is, Dave. Thank you for introducing that for me. Your Daily Dose of Kindness, sponsored now by Mike Novak and listwithnovak.com. We sure appreciate that. A New York City college student is on a mission to find out just how kind we are. He's hitting the streets, handing out treats.
Dorothy, would you like a free donut? Yeah, help yourself. We have napkins there as well.
And with that treat comes just one request. Pass it on.
Take it. Yeah. What's the cause or?
Nothing. Free.
Oh.
Yeah, we're just trying to do some acts of kindness today.
Aww.
Yeah, so if you wouldn't mind taking one of these cards called Kind Card, you can track that number online. And when you give that card to somebody else, you'll be able to see everywhere that the card travels.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah, he's developed a website where these kindness cards he's passing out with the treats can be entered and tracked because he wants to study the ripple effect of acts of kindness. Of course, New York City, far from us. How would we ever participate? Well, there's a way to request a card of your own. I'll put that on my Twitter feed this morning. I'm also going to request a kind card myself, and I'll report back on the results, okay?
Very nice.
All right.
And now, at 7:48... direct from Tom, Jake, and Stacy, weekdays at noon on 710 ESPN. Here is Stacy Rost, and I did not realize that even though the season's over with the Seahawks, their coaches get to go to the Pro Bowl. Here's the coach.
To have a chance to compare, what these guys are capable of looking like, it's not going to be the most intense preparation, that we'll ever go through. But we'll be around them, and I'm sure that by game time, I'm really forward to the game as much as anything. But for comparison purposes, it would be good.
So, Stacey, this is another scouting chance?
I don't think so. They're going to be primarily working with people that are probably locked into contracts because they're going to be stars with other teams. But what I really hope it is a chance for them to go coach these teams, and then there's going to be some, ongoing Twitter conversation about how frustrated people are with them running the ball. That's what I really want to do. I want people to watch it, or, a really close game. I want a very Seahawks football game that finally the rest of the country tuning in that maybe doesn't always watch Seahawks game sees.
Is this considered an honor for the coaches to coach the Pro Bowl, like it is sort of like a bragging right for the players to get chosen?
Yeah, I mean, everyone would always want to go to the Super Bowl, right? There's a reason you're playing in the Pro Bowl. It's because you're really good, but it's also because you're not at the Super Bowl. But to get the honor, you have to be the team that falls out of the divisional round with the highest remaining record. So you still have to be a really good team. It's meant to kind of give it to the last remaining opponent who they think is most deserving.
Maybe you can settle a debate that broke out in the newsroom yesterday. It turns out that Marshawn Lynch is already selling T-shirts with his chicken quote on it. And Chris seems to think that the T-shirts were printed up long ago and that Marshawn Lynch then deliberately used that news conference to publicize the chicken quote strictly in order to sell T-shirts. And, in fact, he doesn't really believe in protecting your chicken or whatever.
That is uncharacteristically cynical of you, Sully.
Yeah, but Beast Mode is a great promoter, and I mean, look at what he. Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't put it past.
But if he's
smart.
So great, why would he need a ploy?
Well, it's a smart thing to do.
Well, can it be both? Is it part of protecting your money and getting more money and being smart about it, doing exactly what he did? But he also obviously cares about it. But that's the epitome of preaching what he's talking about. He's like, no, listen, look at what I just did. Do this. Don't go out and spend all of your money. Be smart about how you make money.
Chris, are you saying that his whole decision to unretire temporarily was mainly to sell T-shirts?
No, I just thought he might be able to see an opportunity that, because why else would he come out and give us one whole minute's worth of content when he's never talked to us before? And then the next day there's a chicken shirt that says the exact same thing that's already printed and available on his website.
But you don't think he believes it at all?
Oh, no, no. I totally believe that he believes it as well. It's just another way that he's great at promoting himself and, you know, being the entrepreneur that he is. I mean, I think he totally believes it. There's no doubt about that. I just think it's really clever. And, if he gets a few extra T-shirt sales out of it, then good on him.
And the reason you don't say more is because that's the only quote people could run then.
Yeah.
That's why you don't say anything else.
Yeah.
Because he only got one soundbite, so the stations have to run the same one over and over again. It just so happens to be on the T-shirt.
Yeah. Great soundbite.
Yeah. Exactly.
All right. The West Seattle woman, who is now the first woman hired as a pro baseball hitting coach for the New York Yankees, Rachel Balcovec. Is she famous here? I have never heard of her.
No, I mean not that I know of, but she is. Her story is still a really cool one. So she actually, the thing that stood out to me, and I don't know if you guys have heard this part of the story. It was publicized when it kind of she was first hired, but. When she was applying to all of these teams, and she has two master's degrees. One is specifically in the science of movement and tracking movement with baseball and cricket. She's incredibly qualified. She was a former D1 athlete. So she was getting no responses from teams at all. So all she did was change her resume from saying Rachel to Ray, and she got a ton of calls.
Yeah.
So I think people that are critiquing and saying, well, she didn't play baseball, and well, she didn't do all of this. All she changed was the fact that she was, potentially a man over a woman, and the exact same qualifications garnered a lot more interest. So I think it's a fascinating story.
This is 100%. My husband experienced the same thing because his name's Chris, spelled with a mm-hmm. K, which is often the abbreviation of Christine, mm-hmm. right? And he was having a hard time finding a job when we were over in Spokane because he had Chris on his resume. He changed it to Christopher, started getting calls.
Yeah.
That's an amazing story. So she starts with the Yankees, and so what's the mark of a successful hitting coach? I mean, will they be able to fire her if she's not good? I guess is the question I'm asking.
I mean, yeah, you can fire anyone if they're not good, but I mean, they clearly hired her because they believe in her, and all of these teams that called wanted to take a chance because they felt that this person was qualified enough to do it. So I mean, you want to look at just, it sounds very simple, but the success of a batter at the plate, because they're literally coaching them to on their swing, how to approach the plate differently, how to hit better and more effectively. It's pretty self-explanatory. But so if you have a ton of strikeouts and if you have teams that are just not hitting, they're trailing everyone in home runs, they're never getting on base, then that might be part of the problem. But because it's just one part of what makes a successful team, it would be hard to pin it just all on her.
Yeah, well, good for her.
I wouldn't be shocked at all if there's criticism that comes out. If any Yankees player takes a step back and someone says, "Well, you hired this person," it's sad, but yeah. I think it's awesome she was hired.
Stacey Rost, our sports insider. Thank you, Stacey. Could this be the year that Washington State, as a state, says no more to single-use plastic bags? Senate Democrats are pushing for that, and Kyra's Hannah Scott is here with the update on that. Hannah.
So, Dave, if this sounds familiar,
today we've reached a crisis-level proportions of plastic pollution.
It should. That's Democratic State Senator Mona Doss pitching her bill to ban single-use plastic bags statewide before a revote in the state Senate yesterday.
We've seen all of the horrifying photos and videos of animals choked by plastics, tangled in garbage, or whose bellies of the whales are full of waste. We've seen all the frightening depictions of massive garbage islands in our oceans, and an estimated 8 million tons of plastics end up in our oceans every year. It's not good for our animals, it's not good for our habitats, for our planet, and it's definitely not good for us. We need to take action.
And she says that action is her bill.
This bill will stop retailers from providing the thin, single-use plastic bags, and they will be able to provide durable plastic bags or paper bags at the carryout checkout stand for 8 cents each. And if shoppers bring their own bag, they won't have to pay anything.
Now, Republican Senator Doug Erickson drove this point home.
The vast majority of plastic waste in the world comes from Asia. And so we in Washington State and the plastic bags generate here, you can't even measure as a percentage the impact this has on those terrible plastic dumps in the ocean. That comes from Asia. So we just need to be clear for the people of Washington State. You are not the issue when it comes to this worldwide plastic problem. It's China. It's Indonesia. It's Southeast Asia. It's those countries where the plastic really comes from that's getting into our oceans right now.
And Republican Senator and candidate for governor Phil Fortunato warned that the move would actually only lead to more plastic use.
I personally take the plastic bag from the grocery store and put it in my trash can in the bathroom. Now I will have to go to the same grocery store and buy a plastic bag, which uses, by the way, 3 and 4 times more plastic than the plastic bag from the grocery store, and use that to line my plastic trash can liner.
Now, Democrats disagreed, and in the end, this did clear the Senate, just like it did last year. It failed in the House last year, by the way. This passed, though, yesterday as the Northwest Progressive Institute released results of a recent survey they had done showing that more than 2 in 3 people in the state support this bag ban. I think 69% of 900 Washington voters that they polled said that they ought to be banned. So.
Well, I mean, that's what people feel, but what is the actual, I mean, is Doug Erickson correct that we are banning the kind of plastic that, in fact, is not the problem? Because here we don't dump our trash into the ocean. It ends up in a landfill, and it's very difficult, it seems to me, for that to get into the ocean. Whereas, I mean, the times I remember very clearly visiting Niger. In Niger,
right.
The dumps are open, the winds pick it up, and of course it eventually ends up in the ocean.
Yeah, and I think that certainly there are many that would say he is absolutely right. I think there's still not a solid agreement on that, but either way, the folks behind this bill say that this any little bit that we can do to get rid of some plastic is going to help. But Mona Doss and those behind this also agree that there is a larger problem, and this isn't going to solve that huge plastic problem that we have in the state. But it's one step. It's a baby step.
I see.
Because we didn't get straws done either. So
we didn't?
Not at the state legislature. Well,
not at the state level, yeah. Well, I've got every kind of straw now. I've got the plastic, yeah. I've got the paper, and I've got a metal straw too, which it's not sharp.
Oh.
But that will last forever.
Well, there you go.
And I promise never to throw it away. Anything else they're going to regulate, or is that it for this year?
Well, I'm sure there's plenty more. This was yesterday was Environmental Day.
Nothing about soda or anything like that?
I've not heard. It's your second host in 2 days to ask me something like that.
I'm just trying to figure it out.
I have not seen that yet, but I will absolutely keep an eye out and let you know if that happens.
Thank you, Hannah.
You bet.
On Thursdays, we bring in the former acting CIA director and the host of the podcast Intelligence Matters, which you can hear Saturdays on Cairo Radio, Michael Morrell. And Michael, we haven't talked since the killing of Qasem Soleimani in Iraq, the Iranian general. And it was portrayed by the president's critics as basically a hit ordered almost, on the spur of the moment by the president. But it doesn't happen that way, right? I mean, these things have to be planned out months in advance, don't they?
So we don't know exactly what happened here. We don't know if this was a plan that happened over weeks and months, or if this really was a spur of the moment decision. There is media reporting on both sides of that question. This was a very bad individual, a lot of American blood on his hands. The world's a better place without him. But the U.S. military does not kill people to bring people to justice for what they've done in the past. They kill people for what they're planning to do in the future. And we don't know if there was very specific intelligence, as the president and secretary of state say, indicating that this guy was planning significant attacks against multiple U.S. embassies, or if the intelligence was less compelling than that, as some of the Democrats on the Hill have been briefed. So we just don't know. So it may have absolutely been the right thing to do. We just don't have enough information. What we do know with absolute certainty is the significant risks that have been created by this at this point. You know, the Iraqis are demanding that we leave Iraq, that the U.S. military leave Iraq. The Iranians have stepped away from the most important constraint on their nuclear program, the enrichment of uranium. And I'm absolutely certain, Dave, that at some point the Iranians are going to try to equal the score. They're going to try to, somewhere in the world, at a time and place of their choosing, assassinate a senior U.S. official who they see as commensurate with General Soleimani's rank. So it may have been the right thing to do. We don't know for sure, but boy, there are significant risks associated with it.
So you think that missile strike that Iran pulled off is not the end of this? Now, let me ask you this. Would the president have been briefed about the likely blowback if he gave the go-ahead?
So in any administration that I served in, this would have been a long process, and that process would have included exactly the kind of assessment you're talking about. What's the likely Iranian response? What's the likely response from Iran's proxies around the world? What's the likely potential benefit to the Iranians? What's the risk to the Iraqis? How are the Israelis going to react to what the Iranians have now done in terms of loosening up the restrictions on uranium enrichment? If I were in Tel Aviv, that's the thing I would be most worried about. So in a normal administration, absolutely, there would have been multiple papers produced by the intelligence community answering all of those kind of questions.
Would the Iranians retaliate by, instead of going after a high U.S. military official, which I think it's fair to say would be difficult, going after a high official in Israel, knowing that if anybody was going to overreact and, you know, start a really annoying regional conflict, it would be Israel?
So if I were the Iranians and I knew I couldn't get a current senior official of the U.S. government because it would just be too hard to get at them given the security around them, what I would do is I would go for a former senior official. And when you're talking about, okay, who might that be, I think you have to know that General Soleimani was essentially the head of the CIA, the head of the Joint Special Operations Command, in the Department of Defense, the head of Central Command in the Department of Defense, and a presidential envoy to the Middle East. So this is an extraordinarily high senior official. So I think there's a good chance that somewhere in the world they'll go after a former U.S. official who no longer has security.
Well, pardon me for bringing this up, but didn't you once run the CIA?
There's probably places in the world where I will choose not to go for some period of time unless the country that I'm visiting provides me with security. Absolutely.
Yeah. All right. Let's not talk about that anymore then. Let's talk about your podcast this weekend where you branch out into the DIA, the Defense Intelligence Agency. And I guess my basic question there is, since you already have a Central Intelligence Agency, why do we need a Defense Intelligence Agency?
So the CIA focuses on the needs of the president, and the Defense Intelligence Agency focuses on the needs of the Secretary of Defense and the chairman of the Joint Chiefs. So the analysis that they do is more military-focused. It's more in-depth in terms of military issues, more in-depth look at weapon systems, the development of future weapon systems. What are the strengths and weaknesses of those weapon systems? How might we develop countermeasures to them? So it's much more defense focused, whereas CIA analysis tends to be more strategically focused.
So you're going to be talking with Lieutenant General Robert Ashley, who's director of the DIA. So they are in charge of making sure, I guess, that we remain the most powerful nation in the world. And I know that has been an issue from time to time. Well, I just saw the pie chart of world defense budgets. I mean, it's not even close, Mike.
Right.
I looked at Russia's defense budget. I can't figure out, when their defense budget is such a tiny sliver, why we even worry about them.
Yeah, I think you have to put our defense spend into the following context. And we do spend an awful lot, and we are the most powerful military in the world, no doubt about it. But I think a little bit of context is important. The first is, we're, unlike Russia, unlike China, unlike Iran, unlike North Korea, we actually pay our soldiers a living wage. They don't. That's a significant percentage of our defense budget. And then the second is, we have to worry about the whole world. You know, we have to worry about Russia. We have to worry about China. We have to worry about Iran. We got to worry about North Korea. We got to worry about terrorists. So we're worried about the whole world, whereas Russia and China, to a bit of a lesser extent, and North Korea and Iran, they really only have to worry about their neighborhoods. So we have a much bigger space to cover than they do. So absolutely, we spend a lot, but I think putting it in that context helps show that it's not as out of proportion as it looks.
Former acting CIA Director Mike Morrell, who hosts Intelligence Matters, you can hear us Saturday right here on Current Radio. Mike, thank you very much. Be careful.
Good to be with you.
Yeah.
You can ring my bell, Rachel Bell.
Seattle's Morning News, this is Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien, and here is Rachel Bell. It works out that Rachel Bell is best buds with Ken Jennings, who we now know is the greatest Jeopardy champion of all time.
That's right. I hope he's not listening because he's going to be like, she thinks we're best friends? That's really weird. Ken Jennings is my neighbor, and he was on my podcast, Your Last Meal, so I have some great clips I'm going to play. For those who have not been following, Jeopardy just came back and did this greatest of all time game. It's the first time they've ever done it. A lot of people have been calling it GOAT is the acronym. It was a big tournament, and this came 15 years after Ken Jennings was the record-breaking Jeopardy champ. He won 74 consecutive games, which is still the record holder for the longest winning streak on Jeopardy. He is the second highest earner. Somebody else has surpassed him by how much money they made on the show. But yeah, that was 15 years ago. This week, he came back to compete against two other legends. I don't know if I'm going to say these guys' names right. James Holzhauer
right.
and Brad Rutter.
Right.
The prize was $1 million. And this week, Ken Jennings became the winner of $1 million. Seattle happens to have a lot of Jeopardy winners. And in the neighborhood he lives in, actually, there are quite a few people who have won.
Really?
There's a bookstore that's owned by a guy who won Jeopardy and was able to quit his job and open this bookstore. So as I mentioned, Ken Jennings was on my podcast, Your Last Meal. I think it was last year. And I asked him where this knack, if I mean, that's just kind of a demeaning word at this point, but where this $1 million knack for trivia began.
Trivia kids are born and not made. Like, you just know if you have that kind of kid that's always dragging the Guinness Book of World Records around and annoying mom and dad with facts about polar bears or whatever. And I was very much that kid. We lived overseas. Our only contact to U.S. culture was like Army TV and radio, because there's like a bajillion U.S. servicemen in Korea. As a result, me and all my friends were obsessed with Jeopardy, because every day after school at 4, that's what the Army put on TV. We would run home from school, and there was only one thing to watch. We all watched Jeopardy, and we were just like an obsessive fan club of Jeopardy, even at 10 years old.
Obviously, you're a smart person, but is trivia more smarts and intelligence, or is it memorization and just being curious and reading a lot of stuff, or both?
Yeah, it's mostly a parlor trick. It does boil down to curiosity. People you see on Jeopardy, they're not savants with photographic memories, you know, Rain Man types. They don't memorize the phone book. They're just really curious about the world, and pretty much without distinction for type of knowledge. You know, most normal people are like, yeah, I'm interested in history, but oh, don't ask me about science, or love baseball, don't really get hockey. You know, trivia people are just omnivorous. And when you're interested in something, facts just stick. So these people aren't trying to know everything. They're just really engaged in the world around them. And without even meaning to, they just know stuff.
So if you've watched Jeopardy before, you know there's the part in the show where Alex Trebek, the host, goes around and he asks the contestants a little question, you learn about them. And so Ken Jennings was on 75 episodes, and so it seems like it would start to run dry of what he could talk to him about.
I remember one time he just got fed up and he was like, Ken, is there anything you want to ask me? And I had no idea this was coming. You know, I hemmed and hawed for, you know, 10 seconds. And I finally said, well, what did you have for breakfast this morning, Alex? And I'll never forget what he said to me. A Diet Pepsi and a Baby Ruth.
What? That is so unexpected.
The breakfast of champions.
So 15 years ago, when Ken Jennings was originally a contestant on Jeopardy, he lived in Utah. And apparently there is a national regional dish of Utah.
Utah has regional food. Do you know what it is?
No.
Jell-O. Utah is well known for its bizarre Jell-O concoctions, like from a 1958 Better Homes and Gardens magazine. Like, my mom makes a Jell-O that has black cherry Jell-O with cubes of cream cheese, slivered almonds, and like some kind of canned cherry, and then like some Dr. Pepper or something in it?
Mixed in, or she just pours it over the whole thing.
Yeah. It's like
and then
lights it on fire.
Yeah.
As she's plating it.
So this episode goes into the history of Jell-O. There's actually a Jell-O museum in Leroy, New York. We talk about why Jell-O is so popular in Utah, and there's a lot more from Ken Jennings, who is hilarious on Twitter and in real life. So I recommend going back to the archives of Your Last Meal and listening to Ken Jennings, the new $1 million Jeopardy winner, greatest of all time.
He's not just about facts, though. If you saw any of that tournament, there was a lot of in-the-moment thinking that had to go on, having nothing to do with facts. I mean, the rhyme time and the one where you had to translate Roman numerals to the initials of celebrities, that you have to have some special brain power to do that in competition with two other really smart people, it seems to me.
Yeah, and so many people watched all week. I mean, I think it was 16 million people. It was one of the most watched shows of the week. And that makes me feel good about humanity that, you know, in our culture, people aren't just interested in reality shows or just interested in sports, that people actually want to watch three great minds compete against each other.
Rachel Bell. Thanks, Rachel.
Thank you.